Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com. It's all true, or it ought to be. So said Winston Churchill of the legend of King Arthur. Romantic historical story or just an invented myth? Well, welcome to The Rest is History with me, Dominic Samrock, and my very own Mordred, Tom Holland. Tom.
I should say that in the script, yeah. Dominic, it says my very own Galahad.
So I know, but I was never going to read that out.
Very subtly done.
Yeah. I was hoping you wouldn't notice. So let's kick off. This is a great subject. King Arthur was my very first historical enthusiasm. So I read the Lady Bird King Arthur books. I read Antonia Fraser's book about the Knights of the Round Table. And I think I read those before I read anything about real kings. That's probably true of lots of people who get into history, isn't it? You start with King Arthur and Robin Hood, and then you get into the, you know, enclosures and dissolution of the monasteries and all the really exciting, glamorous subjects.
Yes. There's always the vague feeling attaching to reading about the enclosures that knights, yeah. Knights with pennants are just a lot more fun. And I suppose hanging over this entire theme is the obvious one, which summed up very effectively by Tom Tague, the UK correspondent for The Atlantic, who asks, Arthur, who, what, why, how? And I guess you could express that as basically, did he exist?
Yeah.
So, Dominic, are you a sceptic or a believer?
Well, that's it. To my mind, I guess if I like to believe that Arthur existed, of course, because I'm a romantic. But ultimately, I suppose my instinct is that there were multiple Arthurs, right? That probably there were multiple warlords and generals, some of them Roman leftovers, some of them Celtic, some of them maybe even Germanic, who sort of fed into the Arthur legend at the end of Roman Britain in that sort of period that we think of as the Dark Ages. And that, you know, it wasn't completely invented, that there must have been grains of truth, as there always are in historical myths. But anyway, Tom, this is your field. You're on home turf. You should be answering this question.
I don't think he existed. You know, this word euhemerism, the idea that in the distant past you have mortals, kings, powerful figures who go on over the course of time, become elevated and end up as gods.
Yeah.
But I think that Arthur is a kind of interesting example of something going the opposite way. That I think he's essentially a kind of mythical figure, a figure of folklore who gets attached to a specific historical narrative. And the reason that that can work is that, as you said, the setting for Arthur are the century, maybe two centuries after the collapse of Roman Britain, which is the two century period that really we struggle to fit a narrative onto it.
Yeah.
We have so few written sources, and the evidence from archaeology, from genetics, and everything is so contradictory and so complex that, in a sense, if you wanted to slot a mythical figure and pretend, imagine, cast him, construct him as someone who had actually existed, that's the period that you would do it. But I think that, I guess there are two problems, really. One is that the sources that mention Arthur are incredibly late.
Right. So they're well after the event.
Yes, almost. So there's a description of a raid that was launched by some Welsh-speaking Britons from the region of Edinburgh against what's thought to be the Roman fort of Catterick. And this is set about, well, about 600. And the guy who is describing it claims, at the beginning of the poem, a guy called Aneurin says, "I am narrating it." And he's supposed to have lived around 600. And in that poem, there is a phrase that this warlord pulls off great feats, but he was not Arthur, is the phrase.
Oh,
so
yes.
if we can identify that at 600, then that is evidence for it being very early.
And Arthur being somebody that people will know, and that people will say, is he an Arthur, isn't he? So that's pretty big, isn't it? I mean, doesn't that suggest...
Except that except that this is a poem that was first written down in the 9th century, and the earliest manuscript we have of it is the 13th century. So okay. There's a lot of potential for Chinese whispers yeah. there. And even if it was, you know, written in 600, he was no Arthur. I mean, Arthur could still be a mythical figure.
Yes, like you'd say he was no Heracles or, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
exactly.
And then what about these people like Gildas? So Gildas is somebody who writes about Arthur, isn't he? Tell me about Gildas.
Right, so Gildas is, again, difficult to pin him down exactly, but he's probably writing about 500. And he does give a kind of garbled narrative of what's going on, even though it's completely shot through with all kinds of Old Testament imagery. So he's not writing a kind of straight history. And right. he gives us a portrait of a haughty tyrant who subsequently gets identified with a guy called Vortigern, inviting Saxon mercenaries in. You have Britain imploding, you have a state of warfare. And this conventionally is the period that you associate with Arthur, but it's not Arthur who is mentioned. It's a guy called Ambrosius Aurelianus, who is described as the last of the Romans. And Arthur isn't there.
So right.
It's a yawning gap. So why does Gildas not mention Arthur? I guess there are various...
But hold on, don't people think that Ambrosius Aurelianus is Arthur? That's a lot of the stuff that I've read. People say, well, this is obviously Arthur, that was his real name. Is that just balderdash?
It's kind of quite desperate because he's not called right. Arthur. I mean, he's called Ambrosius Aurelianus. So why is Gildas not mentioning Arthur? It could be because he hasn't heard of him. Yeah. So Arthur is operating in some other area of the country that the Gildas hasn't heard. Or it could be that Gildas has a problem with Arthur. So in a lot of the early saints' lives that you get in Wales and other Celtic areas, Arthur is often cast as a kind of problematic figure who preys on the right. church. So perhaps that's a reason.
So he's been cancelled. Gildas has cancelled him.
Yeah, or perhaps he just doesn't exist. You know, he's an imaginary figure. And I think that's the likeliest explanation. Where Arthur does appear in what seems to be a historical record is in a Welsh history series of texts, of chronicles and so on, that is attached to the name of a Welsh writer called Nennius. But again, it's all very confusing. And this is the one that gives the famous list of 12 battles that Arthur is supposed to have won, culminating in the Battle of Badon, which we can be fairly confident is a battle that was fought because Gildas mentions it. But he doesn't associate it with Arthur. He doesn't even specifically say that it's Ambrosius Aurelianus who won the Battle of Badon. He doesn't say who the Battle of Badon was against. He doesn't really provide a solid date for it. So the whole thing is a kind of, it's a mess. And I think that being so, you've got to ask, well, why and how would the legend of Arthur emerge? And I think that it's pretty clear that what's going on is that you have a Welsh-speaking tradition that is very hostile to what it sees as a takeover of its lands by Saxons. And likewise, in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, you have a very similar account of Saxons and Angles sweeping westwards, conquering the homelands of the Britons, pushing them into Wales, seen from the other side. And traditionally, this has been understood to be a historical narrative, that the Romans withdraw, that the Britons invite in the Saxons then conquer what becomes England. Arthur supposedly wins the Battle of Badon, keeps the Saxons at bay for a few decades. The Saxons then come back in. And that's a kind of narrative that has been repeated and repeated and is still kind of widely held to. But I think it's a fantastical one. That's not what actually the archaeological evidence shows, and it's not what the genetic evidence shows.
Let me interrupt you. So modern sort of academic historians, very recently, especially if they're quite woke, shall we say, they think that this is the wrong narrative because it presents immigration as kind of contested and it's all done with fire and sword. And they sort of argue, oh no, it was much more gradual and there was an assimilation, that the idea that the Saxons came in and they drove Arthur and the Britons all into Wales is all balderdash, and it was this sort of multicultural process and all the rest of it. Do you buy all that? Is that your take on it all?
I don't think it's about woke anxieties about immigration. I think it's about the fact that all the evidence on the ground, the archaeological evidence, shows very little sign, and the genetic evidence shows very little sign of a kind of mass invasion. Basically, the Angles and the Saxons, like the Welsh, they're all descended from the people who lived in Roman Britain. What seems to have happened is that, for reasons that we can't be absolutely certain about, that the eastern half of the former province of Britannia starts to identify culturally with the kind of the Germanic reaches of the North Sea. And it's a conscious reaction against Romanitas, against the ideals of Rome. And almost as if in reaction to that, the western half of Britain, which had always been less Romanized, very, very radically starts to identify with Roman history, Roman precedents, and so on.
Okay.
And essentially, by the time you get to the 9th and 10th century, what has happened is that these different stories, these different traditions, these different back projections have come to be fossilized so that both the Welsh and the Anglo-Saxons believe that there was a kind of genuine migration. But there is, you know, in terms of the essentially the kind of the cutting edge of academic research at the moment, there's no evidence at all for this migration. And so therefore it becomes more difficult to fit Arthur into that narrative.
Well, okay, let's get back stuck into Arthur. The idea of there being somebody called Arthur, this incredibly romantic figure, when does that really kick in? At what point are educated people swapping the story of Arthur and embellishing it? So is this pre-Norman conquest that this becomes widespread, or is it after that?
Well, you're getting it with Nennius, whoever Nennius was, if he... So you're getting it in as the Anglo-Saxons are starting to kind of solidify the kingdom of England. So you are getting Arthur enshrined as a kind of folk hero for the Welsh.
But not the Saxons, right? No.
And so for...
Alfred doesn't... I mean, he either doesn't know about Arthur or he thinks Arthur is a bad guy. Am I right?
Yeah. So Arthur is not mentioned by Bede, who essentially provides the only narrative that we have for what we could call the Dark Ages. It gets picked up by Alfred, who is sponsoring the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle doesn't mention Arthur either. So essentially, Arthur becomes a folk hero for the Welsh, a reminder of victories won over the Saxons, as they're called. And there's a kind of implicit sense of prophecy. So you also get in Nennius, I think, the first mention of Merlin.
And
with Merlin's prophecies, he is saying that the time will come where the Britons will essentially get back the lowlands, Logre. They will get back England. So it's this idea that Arthur will come again, that the Welsh will reverse the humiliation of their defeat. That's essentially what's powering it.
That's all a fantasy because it never happened. Is that what you're saying? That he's basically inventing this humiliation that never actually took place?
The Anglo-Saxons, obviously, they end up, you know, they identify with the more Germanic traditions to the degree that they end up speaking a Germanic language, that they take on Germanic names, that they trace their origins back to Germanic gods.
Yeah.
And so culturally, this then becomes dominant over the lowlands, and the Romanized Christian Welsh are pushed into, as they say, into the mountain fastnesses. And that's the great cultural divide. And it's one of, obviously, that survives the Norman conquest. And that then muddies the waters further, because essentially Arthur is an inspiration to the Welsh. And then also he becomes quite a potent figure for the Norman conquerors and their heirs, because again, it's kind of putting the English down.
Yeah.
And really the guy who popularizes Arthur as a historical figure is writing in the early 12th century, and that's Geoffrey of Monmouth.
So this is Laura Lawson's question. Laura Lawson, we should get into some questions now, I reckon.
Yes.
Because you and I can talk about King Arthur for, I mean, maybe people were happy to hear that, but we could probably talk witter on for days between ourselves. But Laura Lawson says, basically, how much is it Geoffrey of Monmouth's creation? And you think it is, right?
I think it's Geoffrey Monmouth is absolutely hugely influential. He is constructing, he's writing a history of the kings of Britain, and it's Geoffrey of Monmouth who gives the kind of the entire narrative from Brutus, the Trojan, escaping the sack of Troy, coming to Britain, killing all the giants, establishing his kingdom. And that gives you a sense of the kind of the quality.
The accuracy of...
the accuracy. And it has to be... And he gives us a lot of the familiar story that we now know. So he is the guy who weaves in the story of Arthur with Vortigern, with the arrival of Hengist and Horsa, with Merlin, with this idea of a golden age, where Arthur becomes the king of the whole of Britain. He invades Roman Gaul. He becomes the kind of emperor on the continent as well. So he's an all-conquering kind of superhero. And then there is the war between Mordred and Arthur that ends with Arthur's death, perhaps.
Yeah.
That then, after Arthur's death, then the Britons, everything goes wrong for them. But I think that what is interesting, why is Geoffrey of Monmouth, what's he doing with this? Okay, so the last sentence of his history, he ends it with the reign of Athelstan. And Athelstan is the Anglo-Saxon king who joins all the various Anglo-Saxon kingdoms together to forge the kingdom of England.
Yeah.
But he also claims the supremacy over the whole of Britain. He says he's the king of all of Britain, including the Welsh princes, including all the various kings of what will become Scotland. And Athelstan is a king who is appropriating the Roman traditions as well. So he holds kind of great durbars in Roman cities, and he summons kings from across Britain.
Does he use the word emperor, Tom?
Yes, he does. Yes. So he's an imperator. He's a rex. He's all these kind of qualities. And I think it's telling that Geoffrey Monmouth finishes with Athelstan, because in a sense, what he's doing is back projecting Athelstan's achievements onto the figure of Arthur.
Right.
So I think that Arthur is a kind of a Britonized Athelstan, if you like. He's an emperor who rules over the whole of Britain, who is the heir to Roman traditions, who achieves great things and defeats his enemies. And I think essentially that's what's going on. And I think as well, it's telling that there are Welsh writers who are aware that this is absolute nonsense. So there's Gerald of Wales, splendidly named Gerald of Wales.
Gerald of Wales.
Who describes a man who's possessed by devils. And he says that when the Gospels are placed on the chest of this possessed man, the devils flee away. But if you put a copy of Geoffrey of Monmouth's history on his chest, all the devils come flocking back.
That's historians. That's just historians being bitchy about each other, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. So there's a kind of kickback against the fact that Geoffrey is writing history. But obviously, you know, people have a stake. The Welsh have a stake in it. So they're generally quite keen on it. And of course, the kings of England have a stake in it. Because if Arthur was the king of the whole of Britain, then obviously that's quite useful if you're a Norman king wanting to conquer the Welsh, wanting to conquer the Scots. And because Arthur had invaded and conquered much of the Roman Empire, according to Geoffrey of Monmouth, it's also quite useful if you want to launch a continental invasion. So that's essentially the kind of the context for Arthur that we get by the Middle Ages. He's of use to the kings of England.
And so that's the point at which I guess he gets picked up by the courtly kind of tradition, doesn't he? Chrétien de Troyes and then Malory and all the rest of it. But you did, there's one thing we haven't gone into. So this has started to come up a lot in recent years. We have a question from Killing Me Softly. I know who he is. He's a TV producer called Mick McAvoy. And he says, there's a lot of evidence. He says that King Arthur was from Scotland. We have a Ben Arthur, an Arthur's seat. Merlin has been linked to the ancient royal family based at Dumbarton Rock. So was King Arthur Scottish? How unlike a Scottish listener to write down a claim that something is Scottish and that the English have stolen it. Or indeed the Welsh have stolen it. So do you think, or is that, well, one answer might be that Scottish and Welsh are kind of the same in this period, that there's no clear distinction between the two. Would that be completely untoward, Tom?
Well, the Welsh speakers who give us this early romance where this epic where you get, he was no Arthur.
Yeah.
I mean, they're Welsh speakers. So those traditions, the traditions of Arthur, the traditions of a great warlord who fought the Angles and the Saxons, that's as true if you're a Welsh speaker in, you know, Dumbarton, on the Great Rock of Dumbarton, as it is if you're in what we'd now call Wales. So in that sense, I think, yes, Arthur is a kind of mythic figure for all those who are speaking kind of variants of Welsh. But what, of course, what becomes the Kingdom of Scotland, you know, it's not, the Scots are not interested in Arthur. So it's complex.
So the Cornish obviously claim, I mean, did the Bretons have sometimes made exaggerated claims to Arthur? But what about the Cornish? So you go to Cornwall on holiday and you sort of, there's always this Arthurian sort of legend hanging over the whole time, isn't there? It's a place of standing stones and ruins. And obviously Tintagel, we had lots of questions about Tintagel.
Yes, we got one from Alan Andrew Wilde, who asks how much of Arthur's connection to Tintagel is history versus legend. And I think this is a fascinating question because it goes to the heart of this kind of weird nexus, this web of history and myth and folklore and the late antique and the medieval and the modern attitudes to Arthur. And so having said that, let's have a break. Delayed gratification. We'll come back to it after we listen to the adverts.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History, and we are poised for an answer from Tom Holland all about Tintagel. I can't wait. Tom, tell us, is Tintagel real?
Yeah, so what's Arthur's connection to Tintagel? According to the legend, it's where Arthur is conceived.
Yeah.
And Uther Pendragon, Arthur's father, has fallen in love with Igraine, who is the wife of the Duke of Cornwall. And Uther, being an impetuous man, immediately goes and besieges Tintagel. Merlin comes, offers him access to Igraine while the Duke of Cornwall husband is away. He dies. Uther gets to Igraine and Arthur is conceived.
Is he not in disguise? Isn't Uther not disguised?
Yes, he's disguised
as her husband.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So that's the story.
Poor behaviour, Tom. You've got to...
Very poor behaviour. And also Tintagel is associated with more poor behaviour, the legend of Tristan and Isolde. Tristan, who goes to get the Irish princess, brings her back.
A little women stealing going on in Cornwall.
so that's the connection. How did it come about? It is the case that in the 5th and 6th centuries, Tintagel seems to have been a major centre. So there are all kinds of evidence for trade with the Roman world.
Right.
And that is, so maybe there's a kind of a legacy of folk memories of that, which explains why Arthur is linked to it. But really, the reason why Tintagel is the kind of emblematic image of a kind of romantic medieval castle is because that's what it was in the Middle Ages, because it gets given to a brother of Henry III, Richard, who becomes Richard, Duke of Cornwall. And he basically moves in on Tintagel and builds the castle that we see there now. And even when he was building it, it was in a kind of consciously retro style.
Right, so yeah.
Essentially, Richard Cornwall is building Tintagel to look like he imagines an Arthurian castle should look. And in a sense, that's what you get over and over with the Arthurian myths, is people constantly constructing images of what it should look like. And really, it's still going on to this day, because recent excavations, they found a lump of Roman stone, and there was an inscription on it that perhaps mentioned someone called Artognu.
You're still denying Arthur was real? Unbelievable.
Right, so there are all kinds of problems. It's not Arthur, it's, you know, he's called Artognu. But the English Heritage put out a press release saying, whoa, it is Arthur. And in a sense, what they're doing there is exactly what people were doing in the Middle Ages, not just at Tintagel, but particularly Glastonbury, where the monks at Glastonbury, you know, they're manufacturing the links with Arthur because it will bring in tourists. And essentially, English Heritage, when they're saying, yes, this shows that Arthur existed here, basically they're doing the same. Because, of course, that's, you know, the truth is that Arthur sells. I mean...
Yeah, of course. Of course. Well, let's talk about Arthur specifically, because we had tons of questions about Arthur as a sort of mythic figure. So let's kick off Kern O'Neill. He says, I think rightly, isn't King Arthur similar to a lot of other nations' mythical figures who lay waiting to arise and defend the land when it's in peril? So Finn McCool in Ireland or Siegfried in Germany. Love the podcast, he says, quite rightly. Thank you. But that's true, isn't it, Tom? Arthur is an archetype, really, rather than an individual.
Yes. Well, he becomes the emblem of someone who will come again and save us. And obviously over the past few years... quite a lot of people wondering when he's going to turn up.
Yeah.
But I mean, even in England, we've got Drake as well, haven't we? We've got Drake's drum.
Well, Nemo has a question which is just a gift to you, Tom. So Nemo says, what are the parallels between the legend of King Arthur and another resurrected hero, Jesus Christ? And do you think these similarities are deliberate? So do you think the Arthurian story was kind of modelled on the story of Christ? Is there some truth in that?
No, I don't think so. I think it's about, in a way, the story about Arthur coming again is tied up with the snarl of Anglo-Welsh politics in the Middle Ages, because it's the Welsh who talk about how Arthur will come again, perhaps, and give them back what's now England, but was Britain.
Yeah.
And so the kings of England, they don't want that. And Edward I in particular, who will end up conquering Wales, is massively not interested in the idea of Arthur coming back again. But equally, Edward is very interested in the model of Arthur as someone who rules the whole of Britain. So it's in Edward's reign that you get the focus at Glastonbury on the discovery of Arthur's tomb. The monks kind of miraculously discover it. And the grave of Guinevere, his queen. And there's great kind of pomp and celebration, and Arthur's grave gets moved and enshrined in the heart of the Abbey.
But it's also very it's convenient, right, that it's in England, that they found it in England and not in Wales or Cornwall.
It's incredibly convenient, because essentially what Edward is trying to do is to have the Arthur who conquers the whole of Britain while getting rid of the Arthur who will come again.
Yeah.
And the monks have a massive stake in this, because basically Glastonbury doesn't have many relics. It doesn't have a huge amount of stuff that people want to see. So by discovering Arthur's tomb, they are inventing a cash cow as well. So as far as Edward and the monks at Glastonbury are concerned, everyone's a winner. But that tradition kind of lingers on. And it's expressed most memorably in Malory, where he says, yes, Arthur ended up being buried at Glastonbury, but men do say that he will come again. And he quotes his famous phrase, rex quondam, rex quae futurus, the once and future king.
But it's interesting, because that idea was taken up by the first Tudors, who obviously had Welsh lineage. So when Henry Tudor has landed at Milford Haven and he's marching to Bosworth, there's talk of him as the new Arthur, as he's going across Wales, because it'll allow him to recruit troops. And then Henry VIII loved all of this stuff about Arthur. I mean, it's Henry VIII who paid for this big round table that you see in Winchester, which he had done when Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, was visiting. He wanted to show it off and to show himself off as the new Arthur. And Catherine of Aragon, his first wife, had grown up reading stories of Arthur in the Alhambra in Granada. So by that time, Arthur was this international brand that you sort of bought into if you were a sort of courtly, chivalrous kind of person.
And I think the image of Arthur that's painted on that table in Winchester is consciously designed to evoke the image of Henry VIII as well. I mean, the origins of that table, I think, again, goes back to Edward I's reign. And it's, Edward is essentially building it as a model. And by the time of Edward III's reign, it's come to be seen as the literal round table.
Yeah, round table.
So it's all, yes. And of course, Henry VIII's elder brother was called Arthur.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things is that periodically you get Princess of Wales being called Arthur and they all die, which is...
Only the real Arthur, Tom. Only the real Arthur
yes.
can... Anyway, we've got tons of questions. Let's have another one about the sword. Matthew Drake, he says, I watched Excalibur as a boy, perhaps at way too young an age, but I will be walking my lockdown puppy listening to this, and I want to know if any of the mystery behind the sword is true, and if it exists, where does it rest? So where does the Excalibur come... So Excalibur, people often think Excalibur and the sword and the stone are the same thing, which of course they're not. They're two different swords. Roughly at what point, Tom, do those two swords enter the story? They must be sort of, high Middle Ages inventions, are they?
Yes. So Arthur has kind of various swords. And the famous legend is that he is given it by the Lady of the Lake. And then when he dies, and the famous account of that is in Malory again, and it gets retold brilliantly by Tennyson. Sir Bedivere takes the sword and hurls it back, and the hand dressed in white samite comes from the water and takes the sword and plunges back in. And that's what inspires the famous Monty Python joke in The Holy Grail about strange women lying in ponds distributing swords being considered a reasonable basis for a system of government. But actually, the joke points at the way in which swords are politically potent. So although you have the story that Arthur's sword Excalibur has vanished, and presumably when he comes again, he will have it at his side, actually, there are other traditions that these swords are kind of relics that can be taken and used by people who need them. And the famous example of that is Richard the Lionheart, who is spectacularly not interested in King Arthur, because he takes this sword, and when he meets up with the King of Sicily, and the King of Sicily gives him kind of various gifts, and Richard the Lionheart gives him King Arthur's sword.
Oh, no, he gives it away.
Yeah. But
crazy.
Basically, he's doing it because it's kind of massive one-upmanship. Nobody can compete with King Arthur's sword. I mean, it really puts the King of Sicily in his place.
I like to imagine him travelling with this huge cupboard full of King Arthur's swords, like sort of monastic relics or something. He's giving out to kings left, right and centre.
Yes. So it's again, and it's kind of a bit like the body of Arthur. Is the body of Arthur at Glastonbury, or is he in the Isle of Avalon waiting to come again? And likewise, is Arthur's sword, in the lake with the Lady of the Lake waiting to be handed out again when he comes back? Is it something that Richard the Lionheart can give away as a kind of...
Is it in some mafia boss's house in Sicily, in Corleone, as we speak? But obviously it's had a huge afterlife, hasn't it? I mean, the two examples I can think of are the sword that was broken in The Lord of the Rings, so Anduril, Aragorn's sword, which identifies him as the king, and the one that most people are familiar with, which is Luke Skywalker's lightsaber, which is given in Star Wars, and it's his inheritance.
Sword of power.
It's inheritance from Darth Vader. Only he can wield it. And actually, Star Wars, the first Star Wars film, the original, as we would know it, basically is an Arthurian story. The boy who's been adopted, who wields the sword and rediscovers his inheritance. I mean, in a way, that's actually Harry Potter and his wand. It's the sort of... That's the interesting thing about the Arthurian story, to me. The fact that it's had this immense cultural footprint.
Well, there's a good question here from Chris Cope, who asks, why is there such an enduring interest in this story? You've written a lot about the power of popular stories, and particularly British popular stories. What do you think the source of the power is?
Well, Freud claimed that there was this thing called, I think he called it the family romance, though people will correct me if I'm wrong, that he said children, when they reach an age of about 9, 10, 11, and boys particularly, when they fantasize, as part of their sort of breaking away from their parents, they fantasize that they're adopted or that their real parents are somebody else. And that they often fantasize, they have a daydream that they are the children of rich and powerful people, and they have this hidden inheritance. Maybe that's about the point in your sort of growing up that you become, you know, conscious of disappointments or loneliness or whatever, and you begin to create this sort of dream world for yourself, and you imagine that you've been disappointed by life and your true role lies somewhere else. And I think that's one of the key things to the Arthur story, isn't it? It's that the bit that people always remember is the story of the boy who is overlooked and downtrodden by, you know, pushed around by Kay, who he has to be a squire for.
But that's because of T.H. White, isn't it? I mean, that's the sword in the stone and...
Yeah, but that's I think, what kids often get in. And then, of course, he has all the adventures and all the rest of it. But I think the point at which kids... The thing that adults like and kids probably don't like is Lancelot and Guinevere. You know, my son sort of describes that very dismissively as the love. And says, yeah, he loves all King Arthur, but he can't stand the love. and I think that's the bit that obviously fascinated the Pre-Raphaelites. You know, the sort of doomed romance and all that sort of side of things, and the sort of drippy maidens and stuff.
Maidens.
But why? But
well, that's an Lancelot.
Well, I mean, they're all sort of kind of one thing, isn't it? It's all kind of one thing by that point. But why do you think it's lasted so long, Tom? I mean, why does it have this hold on the cultural imagination?
Well, I think the ideal of Camelot, as you all know, I mean, you know, Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah. Kennedy, Kennedy's.
You know, described her husband's court as Camelot. The idea of a golden age where knights are bold, the glamour of it, the colour of it, the excitement of it. And then when that's combined with the tragic arc of Arthur's story and this kind of tantalising sense that it might come back again, I think it's incredibly powerful, powerful narrative. And actually, I do think that the story of Lancelot and Guinevere is a crucial part of it. It certainly was in the Middle Ages, because in a sense, Lancelot is... I mean, he's a kind of tragic figure because he wants to be the very best that he can at everything. So he wants to be the best knight, the truest knight, to his liege lord. And he wants to be the truest lover. So he is completely true to Guinevere, Arthur's wife. Mm. And that's the kind of the tragedy, is that he can't be both. And so he fails to win the Grail. And then his romance with Guinevere ends up sundering the Round Table, and it leads to the civil war that results in Arthur's death or his departure to the Isle of Avalon or whatever. And so the sense that the Round Table is destroyed by something that is noble and heroic, i.e. Lancelot's desire to be the best, I think is powerful. And I've copied it this out because it's one of my absolute favourite passages of prose. And I don't think that we've had enough amazing passages of prose on this
Tom
podcast.
Tom hasn't done enough recitals.
It's from Mallory's Mort d'Arthur. Mallory writes the kind of, you know, the definitive summing up of the Arthurian romances in the 15th century against the backdrop of the Wars of the Roses. And this is Sir Ector, Lancelot's brother, who, when Lancelot dies, delivers this incredibly powerful threnody to him, this kind of obituary. Ah, Lancelot, he said, thou were head of all Christian knights, and now I dare say, said Sir Ector, thou, Sir Lancelot, there thou liest, that thou were never matched of earthly knight's hand, and thou were the courteous knight that ever bare shield, and thou were the truest friend to thy lover that ever bestrad horse, and thou were the truest lover of a sinful man that ever loved woman, and thou were the kindest man that ever struck with sword, and thou were the goodliest person that ever came among press of knights, and thou was the meekest man, the gentlest, that ever ate in hall among ladies, and thou were the sternest knight to thy mortal foe that ever put spear in the rest.
That's great stuff, isn't it? Yeah, it's great stuff.
Fantastic. And I think that that's a model of heroism that, you know, we still are capable of admiring.
And doomed heroism, because otherwise it would be nauseating. I mean, the doomedness is... So your punishment for taking over the podcast to start doing long recitals is that I get to read out Bill Jones's question. And Bill Jones says, send Holland down the Joseph of Arimathea, Holy Grail, King Arthur, Glastonbury Thorn rabbit hole. Go on, Tom. Dan, you go, but you must come back.
Well, the Holy Grail is part of the kind of romance tradition that we talked about. Chrétien de Troyes writes about it. And then it gets taken up over the course of the Middle Ages. It's assumed to be the cup that Christ drank from at the Last Supper, and it's supposed to have been brought to Britain by Joseph of Arimathea, who in legend comes to be cast as Jesus' uncle. And so that's the root of the story, that when Jesus was a young boy, he came with Joseph of Arimathea, who was supposedly a trader. So that's the thing in Jerusalem, did those feats in ancient times. And it comes to be associated with Glastonbury. And again, the monks at Glastonbury prove very, very successful at kind of appropriating these Arthurian legends and these the kind of the hint of the weird. And the allure of these legends last into the modern age, and you can see it in kind of various ways. So you see it, for instance, in T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland.
The Fisher King.
The Fisher King, who supposedly has been struck a dolorous blow, which I think is such a fantastic... And with his dolorous blow, all the land has become a wasteland, and the attaining of the Grail enables the land to be healed. And Eliot picks up on... a book by a scholar called Jesse Weston, who has written a book, From Ritual to Romance, which casts this as a kind of pagan metaphor that's been Christianized. And Eliot then kind of feeds that into the Wasteland. But of course, it's also there in the film Excalibur, John Borman's film, which is probably, I think, the best cinematic portrayal, a serious portrayal of the Arthurian legends. You've also got Monty Python, of course, which is slightly less serious. But I think it's also there in the Glastonbury Festival. I think it's a crucial part of what makes the Glastonbury Festival what it is. The idea that this festival is taking place at a site that may have been the Isle of Avalon, that may have been where Jesus came, that maybe where Arthur is lying, waiting to come again. The sense of the weird and the strange and the mysterious absolutely kind of infuses the sense of magic that...
He's not going to come during the Glastonbury Festival, is he? He's not going to come during, like, some, you know, Robbie Williams appearance or something.
Oh, it would be amazing, wouldn't it? Headlining.
It would be so disappointing for him. I mean, he'd emerge and, you know, Britain would not be as he had expected, put it that way.
And yet, Glastonbury, you know, of all these kind of these sites, so Tintagel and Winchester and all these other places that have been associated with Arthur, they're basically kind of dead. I mean, the sense of romance has gone.
Yeah.
You go there as tourists. But Glastonbury, I think the vivid sense of magic is there in a way that a pilgrim going there in the Middle Ages might have experienced as well. I think it's a kind of very unique, distinctive place.
I think the key cleavage in this podcast, actually, Tom, is that when push comes to shove, you'd rather go to Glastonbury, to the festival, than to the tea room at Tintagel. And I'd rather go to the tea room at Tintagel.
Possibly.
That's what makes the podcast work.
I justify going to Glastonbury by saying that it was, you know, a historiographical exercise and tapping the sources of English myth.
You'd probably, well, you could claim for it then as a tax deductible expense. So let's talk about, we've talked about films. I think we should talk about books. Do you have a favourite historical retelling of the Arthurian story?
T.H. White.
T.H. White, see, you don't find all that stuff about the animals when he starts changing into fish and things a bit weird.
I love it. And I love all of them. And I love the weird one about the Book of Merlin. Right,
yeah,
the end,
that's too
which
strange.
Never got published, and is which he wrote against a backdrop. I think he wrote it in 1940.
Yeah, absolutely. He'd become a pacifist, I think, hadn't he?
He'd become a pacifist.
Yeah.
He saw the great theme of the Arthurian myth and therefore of the stories that he was telling as being how to avoid war. Yeah. And I think that it just kind of heightens the parody. But you're not a fan.
I find all that very strange, actually. I think T.H. White was a very strange man anyway, incredibly egotistical man. And, the stuff with the wart at the beginning when he's the boy, I mean, that's the stuff that became the cartoon that everybody remembers. But the later stuff, I just find a little bit self-indulgent. The version of Arthur, I mean, there's a brilliant version by Rosemary Sutcliffe called Sword at Sunset, I think.
Yes, which we mentioned on the...
which I think is really, really good. But somebody else who we mentioned in historical novels, and he says these are his best books, and I completely agree with him. Bernard Cornwell, who some listeners may say, oh, well, he's just sort of mass market. You find his books in W.O. Smith's. But his trilogy, I think, about King Arthur is by far the best thing he's ever written. Have you read that?
I haven't, no.
It's good. If you ever it's sort of, what he does is he brings out the sort of Welshness of it, as writers often do these days. And he sort of has all the magic, but in such a way that the people, the characters believe in the magic, but you can kind of see through it. So you can see it as coincidence or as tricks or whatever. And he does it very, the atmosphere is very well conveyed. Anyway, let's talk about politics. Let's talk about politics.
Can I just follow up on the kind of the cultural influence? Because actually, thinking about the podcast we did about fascism.
Yes.
The story of you know, medieval figures with swords coming back and grails and all that kind of stuff. So the grail myth feeds into Wagner's operas.
Of course, Parsifal, yeah.
And thinking about T.H. White writing about Arthur in 1940.
Yeah.
In a way, it's the dog that doesn't bark in the night. The fact that actually Arthur is not, as far as I know, appropriated by fascists.
Or if it is done, I mean, I expect there were efforts. I don't know enough about it, but I think there probably were efforts, but they were so small scale. And maybe Arthur had become too deeply rooted. Do you think? Maybe so that he could resist sort of Wagnerization. I mean, you're right that the sort of, we talked when we did about, when we did our fascism podcast, we talked about how fascism drew on modernism and sort of, but it also obviously drew on this sort of neo-medievalism, didn't it? So there were lots of knights and maidens in.
So Himmler's very into all this. But as far as I know, the British fascists didn't kind of call themselves the Sons of Arthur or something.
No, maybe they'd have been more successful.
Dress up in armour rather than black shirts.
Yes, if there are any potential fascist dictators listening, this is your, you know, we've given you your brand. No, I don't know. I wonder whether King Arthur had then been, was too Victorian.
Yes,
whether
maybe.
Whether he was too identified with kind of William Morrissey people with beards,
you know,
Burne Jones and stuff.
Tennyson.
So it wasn't really appropriate for kind of forward looking, aggressive. There's nothing aggressive about the Arthurian legend, is there? I mean, they don't actually do that much fighting in the sort of canonical Victorian. There's a lot of swooning and sort of looking out of windows and, you know, combing their very long hair.
From a knight.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, one of the most powerful moments in the Mort d'Arthur is when the last battle, where Mordred and Arthur slaughter each other and all their men, and they're all dead, and all the knights of the Round Table. And then almost for the first time, peasants appear in the narrative, and Malory describes them creeping onto the battlefield and stripping them of their armour.
And that's the only point that ordinary people appear in the story at all, I assume.
Yeah, yes. pretty much.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there are no, now that you mention it, there's no sense of the public in the Arthurian. They're just sort of yokels cheering. And
I think that's why, by and large, I mean, a lot of historical fictionalizations of this tend to go back to the Dark Ages. That's what they, you know, it's Arthur as a warlord or Roman or whatever, because then you can situate it back in the mud and the dirt and everything.
So, Tom, I think we haven't exhausted Arthur, but we've probably exhausted our listeners' patience, which is more important. Let's end with Simon George's question. Simon George says, basically, does it matter if he was a real person? He quotes the man who shot Liberty Valance. This is the West, sir, when fact and legend collide, print the legend. So is the whole conversation about the historical truth irrelevant, really? And is the myth the thing that matters?
I think the question of whether he's real or not is a part of the fascination. So in that sense, I mean, there's no way we can ever prove it. I think you've got to be agnostic about it, ultimately. I mean, I personally don't think he existed, but I can't prove he didn't exist. And I think that's absolutely a part of the fascination of it, the sense that you can situate this extraordinary narrative perhaps at a historical moment. But I think the fact that we don't know whether it's true or not is a pretty fundamental part of its appeal. Yeah. What do you think?
No, I think that's obviously the mystery of it is absolutely the core of it. I think, I mean, one of the things we talked about when we did our Stephen Fry Troy podcast, we talked about whether the legend of Troy would die. And actually, Arthur is one story that I don't think will ever die, or at least not in the foreseeable future. And it does live on in all the, I mean, you can see it in The Lord of the Rings, you can see it in Star Wars and all these sort of great pop culture leviathans. And I think the afterlife, who cares about whether Arthur is real or not, because his afterlife is actually more interesting and arguably more important. Anyway.
He comes again.
He does indeed. Well, he keeps coming. That's all we've got time for today. It's a subject that clearly fascinates a lot of you, so please do get in touch with us on Twitter if you've got any observations about what you've heard. We'll be back on Thursday because we've got two podcasts a week now, and we've got another episode of The Rest is History when the great Michael Wood will be with us talking all things China. Bye for now.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.